This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome back to another episode of EdUp Legal. And today I am excited to welcome back to the program again, my guest, Terry Gonzalez, a partner at Alston & Bird and the chair of the firm's education practice. So welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Appreciate the invite and looking forward to chatting with you.
I have to say, I feel fairly fortunate that I was able to rope you into coming back, as you seem to be extremely busy lately. I know you've spent a lot of time helping a bunch of institutions respond to the barrage of BDR claims that they are experiencing.
That is true. There has been a barrage, is the right word, of the amount of BDR claims that the department has dropped on colleges and universities across the country. It's quite amazing.
Well, thank you. I actually was thinking of what would be a good word with impact. So I'm glad that you liked barrage. I also understand you're headed out to California soon to defend a favorable class action trial verdict that you got a couple of years ago on appeal.
That is correct. We have oral argument in an appeal on a certified class action that we tried and won. The class action was filed against a preschool of all things. So happy to defend and looking forward to the oral argument.
Well, so I'm gonna jump right in there because I feel like I've you know, got you in this short window. So again, as always, thank you for coming on. I really enjoy chatting with you about most things higher ed. So in my last episode, if you listen to it, I talked with Tony Guida from Duane Morris about the new regulations that the department handed down in October related to myriad subject matter: financial responsibility, certification and program participation agreements, administrative capability, and ability to benefit. And when Tony and I were prepping, and actually when we recorded, I said to him that we could probably do a podcast episode on each one of these sections. And so I thank him for providing such great overview to the regulations. But when I was editing the podcast and listening to it, I thought, you know, we really could do an episode on each of these because they're so important. So I thank you again for agreeing to come back and sort of talk about the regulations and break them down. So today I thought we could talk first about the section related to what the department refers to as certification, or those related to the program participation agreement, or as I think I said in my first episode and most episodes after that, everything's an acronym, so we'll just say the PPA. So I'd like to start there if that's okay.
Yeah, let's talk about the PPA.
So why don't you give an overview of what is the PPA and what does it mean? And then we can dive into why the department wants to change the regulations surrounding it.
The PPA is the contract between the institution and the Department of Education that allows the institution access to its Title IV student loan program. So it's the contract that allows the institution to have student loans for its students and offer student loans for its students.
And since you've been on the show before, you know my mantra is make legal easy and don't talk like a lawyer, but you refer to it, as do I, as a contract. And I don't really think most people think about the PPA as a contract. And so what is the significance of it being a contract?
Well, I think it's a contract because at the end of a very, very long document, there's a line where the school has to sign their name agreeing to be bound by the terms of that document. The document has a long list of obligations and agreements that the institution must abide by while it is participating in the student loan program. And I also say it is a contract because if the school doesn't comply with some of those requirements that are in that document, it gives the department an opportunity to use its enforcement mechanisms against the schools to redress whatever that failure is by the school.
That's a great segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask you. I would also say for any budding lawyers out there or lawyers listening, in return for agreeing to do all of this, you get to participate in Title IV. And so your typical sort of, you can participate in Title IV if you agree to all of these things, sign your name, you've got a contract. So what powers does the department possess in connection with this program participation agreement? So as you mentioned, and we'll go through some of them, it is really a laundry list of things that an institution agrees to be bound by in order to receive Title IV funding.
It's a long list. In the regulations, there are 35 different requirements. And I think that 35 is actually the floor. For some institutions, the department could add additional requirements that are specific to that school that would go into the PPA.
And so in this set of rulemaking, the department has focused its attention on updating, changing, adding various provisions related to what goes into the program participation agreement. And so maybe we can start first with generally or historically, who on behalf of the institution usually signs the PPA?
Well, typically the president would sign on behalf of the school as its representative of the school. And so the signatory or the individuals bound by the terms of the PPA would be the school itself and the Department of Education. But these regulations change that a little bit to add a requirement that the owner or indirect owners or those who control the school must also sign personally. Now, that language is now in the regulations themselves, but I think it is a practice that the department has been trying to implement for some time over the past, let's call it a couple of years. And now they're just finally putting it into the regulations. And of course, these regulations don't go into effect until July 1 of 24. But now it is in the regulations that owners and direct owners who are in control of the school must also sign and be personally bound.
And I think that's the case. In fact, I think in March of 2022, they issued a guidance document where they expanded the categories of individuals or organizations that they wanted to sign the PPAs. So let me ask two questions. First question is why? Why do they want more people or more organizations signing than just the institution if the money is going to the institution?
I think the short answer for that is the department wants those who control the school to have skin in the game, to be, liable for the conduct of the school if it engages in some kind of misconduct or some kind of wrongdoing, that they want the people at the top to understand that they are at risk and they don't get to stand behind the quote unquote, the business alone and not have, it's their own risk in the program.
So when we look at publicly traded or what we refer to, I guess, as proprietary institutions, which, both of us have had experience working for, or you look at institutions that may be backed by private equity, I think that sort of description, it's easy to understand. It makes sense who they're talking about, I guess I should say, not easy to understand why, but who they're talking about. Having spent the last 5 years of my career in a nonprofit, you know, we would shout from the rooftops, nonprofits do not have owners. That is just a corporate reality. So what does that mean when we're talking about nonprofits? Who are the potential, you know, organizations or people that could be asked to sign in a nonprofit? Because we do know that that is happening. So maybe giving, you know, giving some context for what does it mean to anyone who's listening who says, oh, well, that doesn't apply to me. My institution's a nonprofit.
Yeah, it's interesting. And there are a number of different models out there with respect to nonprofits. And if you think about those nonprofits who have affiliates, or they're affiliated in one way with another institution, the department has been taking the position that both the affiliate and the school itself must sign the PPA and be bound, particularly if that affiliate is providing substantial services, you know, such as marketing or compliance or even the administration of Title IV, that affiliate must sign in addition to the institution itself.
You think there's much hope for an institution that gets a request to sign a PPA, or not an institution, but one of these related organizations or people alleged to have control, to question whether that really applies to them, or to tell the department, no, I don't think so. We don't really want to sign.
Yeah, I think when you are negotiating the PPA with the department, I think they have a slightly better hand than most institutions. And that if you had to choose a deck of cards or a hand, that you would probably want theirs. It's probably the more winning one. Kidding aside, the department is probably unlikely going to make too many changes to the terms of a PPA, and is probably not likely going to decide, no, we don't need you to sign. I think this is this new regulation that they have put in has been on their mind, has been on their agenda, and they think it's important for accountability. And they want those people who are providing services to institutions, those people who control the institutions, to be accountable for the work that they're doing.
So the moment passed, but I am going to confirm that you did make a joke. Yes.
It happens once in a while.
Okay, fair enough.
It can happen when we talk about some of the things that this department is doing. You know, you might even get another one if you ask more questions about BDR, but we can save that for another day.
Wow. All right. I'm going to try to get a second joke out of you. So let's move on to, so now we've talked a little bit about, you know, who used to sign the PPAs and what these new regulations provide for signing them. And so I'd like to move into some of the more substantive new requirements, and they don't really fit very nicely together. Some of them seem fairly random when you kind of line them up. But let's talk about one that relates to a practice that many institutions have done over time, which is a debt management tool, which is the idea that if they had students that owed balances to the institution, institutions would withhold transcripts in order to get paid. And I know in California banned this practice a few years ago. I think maybe Illinois did as well. But now we see something very similar under these new regulations. So maybe talk a little bit about that as to why and what it means for institutions that are going to be receiving Title IV funds.
So let me start with the why. I think the department was concerned that when a student was struggling financially or was in debt or owed the institution something, that they were unable to move on either to another institution or to apply for employment unless they paid the school all of the money that it owed, i.e. the school would withhold its transcript and he wouldn't be able to go to another school, wouldn't maybe be able to apply for a job and show the education that they had. And I think they were concerned that that was inhibiting that student's progress, and it's probably not in the best interest of really all of us. I think that's why they made the change that they did, which is to prohibit the institutions from having a policy that would not allow them access to their transcript if it is a Title IV school that has federal student loans, and that it's not related to some sort of misconduct by the school themselves. So it is in line with the state laws that you mentioned, you know, California and the others who have who have banned that sort of practice of withholding transcripts when a debt is owed.
I'd like to say, well, that's a great segue into the next thing I want to talk about, but it's really not a segue at all. But one of the other interesting new requirements for certification and in the PPA is something that's been on the department's radar screen in one form or another for several years. And that's the way in which institutions deal with disclosures about programs that lead to licensure. And I want to say, gosh, I don't know how many years ago it was, but several years ago, the department started sort of playing with this concept, saying, we're going to give you regulations about what you have to tell students about whether a program meets what we refer to as the educational prerequisites. So in other words, if you get licensed, you have to do certain educational things. Maybe you have to do some field hours. Maybe you have to take a test, whatever it is. But those requirements that a state or a licensing body requires for education. And they started coming up with rules about you have to tell your students, you have to say where you meet those requirements, what states you don't. So it seems like now they've kind of gone one step deeper. They've put it as a requirement in the certification in the PPA. So talk a little bit about that, because I think that really is one of the ones, in my opinion, and who knows, I'm just the host, but in my opinion, is going to be a really heavy lift for some institutions, particularly that have distance education in many states.
Yeah, I think it's about 5 years ago that they started making this requirement of if the program leads to an outcome where you need licensure or a certification to engage in that field of employment, they would have wanted you to say this program meets the state's requirements, it does not meet the state's requirements, or we have not made a determination on whether it does or not. And I think that's the way it's been for some time. So as I put it, in my mind, it meets, does not meet, or we don't know. These new regulations took away the we don't know. You now have to be able to say either affirmatively or not that it either meets the programs or it does not meet the state requirements. And if you don't know, there's a simple remedy. You can just no longer offer that program in the states where you don't know. So the department is not being, you know, draconian. They are saying that you do have time to implement it, but you do need to figure out whether that particular program's outcomes meets the requirements of that given state, and you need to disclose that to your students.
And so, being the regulatory nerd that I am, I didn't read the entire Federal Register publication on this, but I did read some of it. And there were a bunch of for those listening, when the department issues sort of new rulemaking, one of the things it's required to do is review all of the comments that people and organizations submit about the rules and respond to them. And so I noticed that there were a bunch of comments that said, wow, you know, that's a really heavy lift for an institution. You know, that could be really expensive. How are we going to keep up with all of that? Why do we have to keep doing that? And I don't know if you read them as well. So I'll put you on the spot and say, if you read them, I was very intrigued by the department's response to those comments. So I don't know, did you read what the department's response to those comments was?
I, like you, did not read the entire Federal Register, but I did read portions of it. And I had a wonderful podcast host who pointed me to this specific provision. So I did actually read that part. And that is where the department said a couple of different things. One, you know, you have to come into compliance, and we hope you can do so soon. But if you can't, you have a couple of options. And one is to not offer the program in that given state. But the other program is you don't have to participate in Title IV funding either. And both of those are the invitations that the department has offered in case you can't meet this burden that they've imposed upon you.
Yeah, that one sort of seems just, you know, sort of thinking off the cuff, that you could understand why students would want to know when they enroll in a program that this program, especially distance ed, will allow me to be licensed or finish the education prerequisites to be licensed in the state I live in and I want to practice in. But My gosh, it really does seem like a heavy lift to be constantly looking at the regulations. And you know, I don't know that there's a central way to be notified every time a licensing body changes educational prerequisites.
Yeah, as I think about it, it is, to me, you know, who bears the burden of determining whether the education that's going to be provided meets what I want to accomplish in a given state? And if I had to guess, the department said, we're going to shift that burden from the student to the school because we think the school is probably in a better place to make that determination for each given state. And they're, you know, higher education regulatory experts at these institutions, and our students are not. And so I think when the department is considering student protections, and they shift this burden from the student to the school, I have to guess that's why they did it. And that's why they put these regulations in here.
Yeah. The other, I guess, you know, there's a few other nuanced things in this part of the regulations, but I think the other maybe big piece is the regulations or the new rules with respect to provisional certification under your PPA. So could you give us sort of, what does it mean to be provisionally certified?
It's your training wheels. We're going to allow you to participate in Title IV. We're not going to give you full certification and tell you that you're blessed and you can operate within the student loan program. But we're going to give you a try. We're going to see how you do. Under the old rules, if the department sat on your provisional certification for 12 months and didn't act, it automatically converted to full certification and you were in the program. That's one of the things that they removed and they took out. But they did other things. And one of the other things that they did with respect to provisional certification is what actions trigger a provisional certification. One of those is if there's a new owner, you then automatically move from a regular, a fully certified PPA to a provisional certification. Another one is if you move from a for-profit status to a nonprofit status, that triggers provisional certification. So these new regulations implemented a bunch of new areas where provisional certification could arise for a given institution.
I have to say this area has probably one of my favorite acronyms because once you close a transaction that brings on a new owner, your initial ability to keep distributing Title IV is temporary. So you are in the temporary provisional program participation agreement. So you're TPPPA. So I think you got to say that 10 times fast on a Friday afternoon.
There you go.
So anything else? I want to sort of wrap up with a different topic, but anything else with respect to, you know, portions of the certification part of these regulations that you would want to highlight?
Yeah, it was interesting. One of the things that they did, they have a group of entities that are allowed to share information about the institution that the department can consider when making its decision to allow them entrance into the student loan program. And they specifically added a number of institutions, and that includes all federal agencies and state attorney generals are now allowed to share information with the Department of Education about their view of that institution when the department is reviewing its PPA or renewing its PPA. And I look to that as, again, greater oversight of the institution and an effort by the department to leverage some of the resources of the other bodies that regulate institutions of higher ed and get the information from them. From the institution's view, it may not be so thrilled about that. They may have received a subpoena or a request from documents from a state attorney general or from the Department of Justice or the FTC. Now that issue is no longer solely between the institution and that regulatory body, those bodies can say, look, we are asking these questions of this institution because we are suspicious of their business conduct.
So no standards around what they can say or how you sort of vet or, as we litigators say, judge the credibility of the information that's coming to the department.
And I'm not quite sure that the institution gets an opportunity to say, okay, this is what they're saying about us, but let us, you know, hear our side of the story as to why we think, you know, we are in compliance with whatever business conduct is at issue at the given time.
Do the regulations even provide or address whether the institution will be notified or alerted that the department has received information from a state attorney general or another federal agency? I don't know the answer. It's not a trick question. Just so you know, I really don't know the answer.
And neither do I. Okay. My guess is that the answer is no, but I don't know for sure.
So I guess the next place I just want to go as we wrap up is that, you know, question where, or that question that I like to provide sort of, you know, takeaways for people listening, you know, what should they be doing next? And, I think maybe I'd want to focus on getting ready for making sure that you're in compliance with the licensing disclosure requirements, because as you aptly pointed out, you've lost that third bucket. Right. You've lost that. I haven't made a decision. So maybe talk a little bit about that. And when you were talking earlier about the PPA and its, you know, 35 plus requirements, it reminded me of something that I developed in my nonprofit system, which was a PPA audit. So talk a little bit about, you've got all these regulations and they're all over the institution. They're not centralized in one place. So maybe suggesting some best practices for how do you ensure that your institution is actually in compliance with its PPA in maybe some sort of a centralized format? So number one, licensure, and number two, how do I know that my institution is complying with its PPA?
Let me take that one first. When I look at these new regulations that go into effect in about 8 months, they're pretty sweeping, and there really is a lot there. And it's good that the department has given institutions some time to get their arms wrapped around them, because there are some significant changes that they need to do. It is really going to require sort of a careful read and a careful review of what is new and what is required, and figuring out how to implement those things fairly efficiently on a go forward basis. For the licensure, were you referring specifically to the state licensure requirements and the program requirements that we were discussing earlier?
Yes.
Yeah, I have, you know, a similar comment of how to ensure that you're complying with those rules. It is almost the, you know, what us lawyers refer to as the, you know, the 50 state survey, right? And looking at the requirements in each and every state in which you are providing an education to a given student. I think the complication there is it addresses when a student moves as well. And if it moves from one state to another state, you know, then are you compliant in that state? That is, to me, you know, just a heavy lift of doing the work of, you know, what are the requirements in each of these states that have to be done. And at least for that one, it's not sort of a hard trigger as of July 1. The department seems to recognize that it's going to take a minute or two to do that. But doing the analysis for every program you offer across all 50 states, I don't know any other way to say, but it is a fairly, you know, onerous requirement. It's a heavy lift. Now, it's quite possible that much of the work has already been done, because for many years we've been saying does meet, does not meet, and we don't know. So you're really focused on the we don't know, or we haven't determined yet, and that may be where your focus is. So the list may not be quite as heavy. But when I add that in with all of the other requirements that have included in these regulations, there's a lot there. And, you know, today we spoke about the certification process and some of those other provisions. But as you mentioned, there's new reporting requirements. There's new compliance requirements regarding, you know, career services and financial aid, and, you know, the other triggers that require reporting. There's a lot of changes there, and a lot more to discuss in upcoming episodes.
I was going to say that's a perfect way to end, because as you know, I have asked you to help me dig into each one of these. So I look forward to getting back together again next week and diving into the next one. So as always, you know, thanks for giving us your expertise and for making a joke or two on a Friday afternoon. I appreciate it.
The levity on a Friday afternoon. Great to be on your podcast again. Thank you very much for the invitation.
You are always welcome.